I say welcome to part two of my conversation with Emmett Peppers. In this section, we're going to be talking about a possible Tesla stock split. We're going to talk about the overall markets, a possible Delta variant with COVID, how that affects things, a possible Starlink IPO, and the Cybertruck. So wanting to get right into it, how are you doing, Emmett, for our second part here?
Good, good, Dave. Yeah, I'm glad to go over these extra topics. It sounds interesting.
Yeah, looking forward to it. So I'm curious if you can give us an update first on your Tesla positions. What kind of maybe generally percent of your portfolio is in Tesla stock versus options, and what kind of options, right, are you in?
Yeah, I mean, I have my IRA account, my personal account, and then the fund, the hedge fund account that I manage with Matt Smith now, actually. I think you had him interviewed a while back. But my personal tax account, taxable account, and my IRA account, mostly it's the same. I'm not really actively trading those. It's mostly just long-term stock and some long-term in the money, way in the money leaps that I still have. And I haven't really touched those and managed those. I thought long and hard about doing a similar trade in those that we sort of did in the fund, most of our stock in the fund, which I've talked about on here, which has been very good. And I probably should have done that, but I just didn't. I have a lot of tax consequences, obviously, if I liquidate in the taxable account, but I could have done an IRA account, and maybe I should still do that. But, basically in the fund, we converted most of our Tesla stock into selling deep in the money puts for June 2023, 1,000 strike puts, and we sold them around $500. They're around $450 now, so we've already done quite well on them, and we think that's a good risk reward for you have to take what the market's going to give you, and mm-hmm. Like you and I have talked about, Tesla's not going to go up 10x again. The next year or two, I don't know, it's 500, 600 billion market cap company now. Maybe by the end of the decade. Yeah. But in the next year or two, that's as far out as the long-term options go. Maybe we'd be lucky if it doubles, I'm thinking, and that could happen, especially if the full self-driving takes off faster than we seem to think at this point. But I think selling the 1,000 strike puts just makes a lot of sense. They're around $500 of premium. You put up an extra like $250 of equity for the margin. And so instead of owning, two and a half shares of Tesla, you could sell 2.5 of those puts for owning one share of Tesla, basically, mm-hmm. is what I meant to say. So you can get a much better kind of what we call delta dollar exposure on Tesla. And the downside is if Tesla goes down below $500 within 2 years, in June 2023, that's 2 years away, then you lose money on the trade, the farther down goes below $500. But to me, that seems very improbable, to be under 500 billion market cap when it's producing 2 million cars plus a year, growing 50% per year. That seems very unlikely to me. Yeah. And so it may stay around. Maybe it goes 1,000. The best case would be if it goes to $1,000 or above, then you collect the whole $500 premium and you keep it for yourself. And for the amount of capital it takes to put up, what we felt was comfortable for the margin requirement of selling the put versus holding the stock, then you'd have to have the stock go from, $630 to $2,000 plus to make more money holding the stock versus doing these put transactions, so for us, it just felt like a good risk reward. And we did that for a large part of our stock position, if that makes mm-hmm. sense.
Got it. With your personal fund, or your IRA as well, like with your deep in the money calls, for those that are expiring this year, are you concerned at all having to sell and pay taxes and, close them up? Or are you thinking of exercising them? If you have cash, what's your thoughts?
Yeah, luckily I don't have any expiring this year left. I have some expiring next year in June. That's, the ones I have at this point. And so at some point, I'll probably wait till next calendar year to close out of some of those, hopefully on a high note of the stock. I'm just trying to kick the can down the road as much as I can on tax consequences. I already have an enormous tax bill from that S&P trade I'm managing. You know, basically half the money, you know, I make goes to, is going to taxes, and so I have to figure out how to pay for that. And every time I sell something, it generates a new tax bill of half of that. You know, so it's just kind of a never-ending spiral. But it's a good problem to have. I'm happy to have that problem, right? And even though I'm living in California, where the state tax is high, and you know, I'm paying taxes on most of it and doing some tax strategies to limit all the taxes, but I'm certainly paying a lot.
Daryl SJ on Twitter says, selling cover calls to make a weekly income, recommended or not? I remember Gary Black was tweeted about, you know, saying it's a great thing to sell cover calls on Tesla to make some income there. What are your thoughts? Are you selling any cover calls on Tesla?
I have not. No, I mean, it seems like for the last few months, it probably could have been a decent idea. But there's been a couple of weeks where Tesla goes up like $100 in a week or something. And those weeks, that's kind of risky. You know, it's like, that's really stressful, probably, you know, because typically, you're probably selling covered calls, weekly covered calls, like, maybe, I don't know what the strategy people are doing. But to me, to be worth it, I'd want to be collecting at least like a couple dollars of premium for each, you know, so it's like, you want to sell it like $50 or it depends on what the implied volatility is around the option at the time. But when I've looked at it, it seems like not a great risk reward. You know, I'd have to sell like $30 or $40 or $50 out of the money. And we've seen Tesla go up $50 in a day. And you just don't know when that's going to happen again, you know. And it's not for my stomach. That's not how I want to make. I don't want to make 10% a year doing that. You know, I want to make, you know, a lot more than that over time. Uh-huh. But at some point, I'd like to do that for income. You know, on a portion of my position, maybe sell like a month or 2 month out covered calls, where I feel like on maybe like 25% of my position to generate income. You know, so if it did get called out of the money, then, okay, I liquidated some of it. No big, you know, maybe that's not the worst thing in the world for me anyway, but maybe I can collect income along the way, something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems like with selling cover calls, like I was trying it for a few weeks, selling like $150 out of the money. Like maybe if it was at, you know, 700, maybe 850 or 880 or something. And I felt like a strike, and I felt like that week or the following week. And I felt like it was such a stressful experience, because I think if you have loose hands with your Tesla stock, meaning like it's okay if it gets called away and whatever, then I think it's fine. You know, if you're not like, but for me, it's like I've got a ton of like tax consequences. My entire basically stock price is, you know,
taxable.
Capital gains, right? And so it's like, and I don't plan to sell these things, you know, in the near future. So it's like, I don't have very loose hands, you know, I have very careful hands, and it's just the stress is just so, you know, it's just like, I don't know if it's worth it, you know, in my situation. But for other people who, you know, you get in at like $500-$600, right? And you have loose hands, you know, you're just making a trade for a year or so or 2 years. And it feels like, you know, it's definitely an option there. A couple questions here. Big Arc says, I really enjoyed Emmett's story on his big bet in early 2020 that paid off. How concerned is he about the impact of COVID variants like Delta that could have an impact on the macro investment environment during what some feel is a shaky recovery? Are you adding cash reserves? If so, what percent? And then Leonard Chung says, with the U.S. equity indexes it inching to new all-time highs, would Emmett consider buying QQQ puts again like he did in early 2020 this time around?
Yeah, so I guess to catch up, you have a lot of subscribers these days. From the early days when we were talking, I guess we were talking about how I bought a bunch of QQQ puts in NASDAQ index ETF puts, basically. In actually, I bought it first in, I think, end of January, and they expired worthless. And I just bought them again soon after for a longer, and they, you know, I think I, to hedge my portfolio, because I thought that the market would crash, and it did. And I got out at the right time at the low and deployed that for more growth stock. Anyway, long story short, I don't I don't have confidence enough that this Delta variant is like that serious. Like, I think it's spreading like wildfire, but I think it's like the common cold to everyone who's been vaccinated, and hopefully everyone who knows they're vulnerable has been vaccinated. So I think people are sick of like the mask mandates. You know, I think it's sort of being enforced a little bit halfway in parts of California and maybe some other places. But, you know, the thing going against it is the news cycle. You know, if there's no other news headlines out, especially in the next like few weeks, I think the news headlines are just going to go nuts with this Delta variant and try to make it as sensational and crazy as they can, because that's how they get clicks, you know, and it's going to tap into people's fears of last year. And so that's my worry, is the news cycle going to put this thing out of control and, you know, create some anecdotal stories of young kids getting it and dying, you know, and just brainwashing so many people into thinking like, hey, this is part two of a much worse thing, you know. And I'll watch carefully to make sure this doesn't evolve into something more deadly, you know, than what it appears to be so far, obviously. So that's the real, in my view, risk, is if this Delta variant was to evolve into a more deadly version, like the Epsilon or whatever they call the next version that hasn't been named yet, I guess, if it involves them. But I don't, hopefully that's not going to happen. I think it would have happened in like India or the UK or something. There's some like law of viruses, I think, where the more contagious they get, the less deadly they typically are. I'm not sure if that's the case with this one, since, you know, in my mind, it's a lab generated virus. So maybe there's weird properties to it. I don't know. But I know people aren't made up on that. Some people think it's, you know, from the, you know, came from animals naturally or whatever. So there's a lot of unknowns out there. I'm not confident enough that the market's going to crash to be buying puts. You know, I do think there's a pretty decent chance there's like a 5 or 10% hit. And maybe we're already kind of in the midst of that a little bit from the highs, mm-hmm. Of people kind of jittery. But that's the trap, is to me, is like, all right, once the market goes down 3 or 4% in a day next week, I don't want to be selling there, because I feel like that could be the low. And then I don't know. I'm not as confident this time around as I was, you know, a year and a half ago or whatever. So I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on this, Dave, on the Delta variant?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not, I think we're at a different place in terms of preparedness, and also with the vaccine mm-hmm. rollouts and masks. I think if we're actually like, you know, had the knowledge and the cultural acceptance of masks that we do now back like the beginning of COVID, I don't think we would have had such a drastic impact or shutdown. Because look at some countries like, you know, South Korea, Singapore, and others. They just really went with masks and, you know, were able to keep the cases down. So I think, it's a different world we live in right now. I don't know. I'll keep my eyes open as well, you know, to see how things play out, though. You tweeted recently about this podcast on inflation. And I'll go ahead and link it in the video description. So I listened to it. I thought it was a great episode. And I'm curious what stuck out about that, and what are your thoughts about inflation, and more specifically, like, how does that affect any of your investment thinking going forward in the next few years?
I would say that the podcast, the guy who was talking, I can't remember the guy's name off the top of my head, but I tweeted it, and you'll link it in the show notes. A guy from Macquarie Bank, some guy like global head of Asian equities or something like that, equity strategy or something. And he's written a book, and I just ordered his book, even though I don't read many books, but I was so impressed. I listened to the podcast two times. Because everything he was saying just made sense to me. It just rung true to me. Like, it felt like, oh, this is what I've been like. It's almost like he was just kind of putting into words kind of what naturally fit in my head as being correct, you know, is about what's going on. And it seemed, the gist of it was that like, inflation the way we saw in the past will never really happen again. We're kind of in this like pendulum swinging back and forth between a little bit of inflation, and then the banks and, you know, the Federal Reserve and all that will swing it back to disinflation, and then it'll swing back slowly towards inflation, swing back towards disinflation. It's just like a pendulum kind of swinging back and forth between a little bit of inflation, but disinflation too. And it's sort of similar to what I think Kathy Wood has said in a couple of her weekly podcasts they do about, you know, how they think that we're in almost a period of deflation more than inflation, and in a bigger picture point of view, at least. And so I sort of agree with that. I think the times of interest rates being at 5% or 10 or 20%, especially, are way long gone. And I think you have technology progressing so fast. He said something about like everything is going to go to zero. And he kind of expounded upon that. And basically, you know, just like so many things, getting information on the internet is free, or watching TV is pretty much free on the internet, you know, like information is free. Trading is practically free, you know, in a lot of cases, you know. So like everything is going to become free, even like physical goods, you know, and to some degree are going to become free, you know, over the next 10 or 20 years. Like it's just going to change the whole economy as we know it to something very different. And it was just fascinating, everything he kind of expounded upon. And so, yeah, definitely I encourage everyone to listen to his views, because I feel like that type of view is not put out there enough in kind of traditional financial media, who's kind of stuck in the 1990s or 1980s way of inflation rates and early 2000s. And this is a more progressive view of like, okay, that was the past, but this is the future. You know, like people have to accept it. This is a new reality we're in, you know. So it was interesting to me. And I don't know if that helps explain. I can't recall my recollection memory is not as good as recognizing, you know, but I can't recall the terms he said, but everything he said, I just made a lot of sense to me, almost everything. I mean, it's very theoretical in a lot of ways. So in some ways, when people talk very theoretically, I think, you know, nothing goes to theory, but generally speaking, I think he's right. There'll be hiccups and unknown things that happen, but generally speaking, I think his view was very correct or spot on for the future.
Yeah. I thought, it's interesting because I actually also was thinking just a few days ago with inflation, I was thinking like, I think people are getting it wrong. Like, you know, some people are saying there's going to be this massive inflation, but then I think they're underestimating the disinflationary, the deflationary forces of technology, but also especially AI. You know, we have like compute power just massively increasing the power of neural nets and artificial intelligence. And that is like, man, it's like so crazy, the impacts I think it's going to have. But on the flip side, you have this fiscal policy, the government spending like crazy, borrowing like crazy, printing like crazy. And you see asset prices increasing. You do see a bump in real estate and all this stuff. So it seems like in some ways we live in this kind of weird world where there is inflation in some ways, but then there isn't. There's a deflationary force in some ways too. It seems much more complicated than what most people are like making it out to be. You know, the whole inflation story. And when I was listening to that podcast, and we'll link it in the show description, but I thought it was interesting. He was basically saying that the solution, or what he sees, is you'll have periods where you have inflation due to like fiscal policy or something, but then you'll have periods where it'll go back to more like low inflation because of the deflationary, you know, forces. And so it could just be kind of like this, you know, cycle that's different than the past, right? And it looks very different, and it's something that people can't understand right now because they're always using models from the past to try to understand the present, and they can't adapt. And so, it's definitely interesting. For me personally, it doesn't necessarily change my, you know, investing philosophies per se. It seems like overall stocks, companies, equities, the best ones will do very well in this environment. Yeah. But how about you? Does it change any of your investment thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, it makes me more confident in a company like Tesla that's progressive and adapting to, you know, they're one of the first companies to buy Bitcoin, even though we're not necessarily fans or it's, you know, whatever. It's just they're willing to adapt to a new financial era, you know, and those companies are going to, you know, he sort of stated, and I sort of agree with, the companies that are willing to adapt to new technologies, new things, will thrive and do well. The companies that are having a harder time adapting, You know, they don't have to be, whether you're innovating, you know, if you're innovating, that's good too. But if you're not like really innovating as a company and you're just adapting to the innovations, that's good. But if you're a company that's not really innovated and not really adapting, you're in big trouble, you know? And so I think there's a lot of companies out there like that, that are going to, you know, whether it's internal combustion engine car companies or that we talk about a lot or whatever, there's just a lot of companies that are not adapting to kind of the innovations of today, and they're not innovating themselves that much either. And those are kind of doomed in the next 5 or 10 years, in my opinion.
Yeah. Because if you think about it, like some of the deflationary tech forces, like before we had computers, you had the internet and all this stuff, but now we're moving into more of this artificial intelligence and other things that are bringing down prices and bringing up efficiency and productivity. But that's a lot of the benefits are going to be accrued by companies who are, whose expertise is that, right? They can ride those forces. And if you're a company that, and you're invested in companies that aren't very good with AI, then you are, that company is in kind of a suspect position, right?
Yeah.
You have to question.
And if that company isn't, maybe if that company was embracing the experts on AI to use them in their business, but if the company's not even embracing, one of the first ones to embrace that weak point they have of innovating, then yeah, I think, yeah, you're right. It's a concern.
Yeah. I've had this idea of like, just split up the S&P 500 and grade the companies that like, you know, have AI expertise or openness willing, and like, just put them in a basket and remove all the rest, and you'll do so much better than overall, right? Yeah. The S&P 500. I want to move on to Starlink. So we have a couple questions here. Amit Rana on Twitter says, ask Amit, when does he think Starlink can IPO? Which year and any time frame? So Starlink is the internet constellation put out by SpaceX right now. It's getting off the ground already. I forget how many subscribers, like 50,000, or I forget, it has decent amounts.
Yeah, they're growing. Yeah, it's in the tens of, maybe might be getting closer to 100,000 soon. I don't know. We'll see I'm sure, an announcement when it gets that high. But yeah, I mean, I'm taking Elon at his word. I think he said a few years away last or something like that. Mm-hmm. You know, he's pretty genuine. You know, I think they have a long way to go to become profitable. But I know you've done some, Dave, you've done deep dives on Starlink. You know that space as well as any analyst, in my opinion. I mean, what do you think about it in terms of how long it could be till it IPOs?
I wish it would IPO ASAP, you know, so we can get in at a best valuation. Once it, like, I think Elon wants to, you know, make sure it's profitable, it's stable, but then by that time, it's going to be a safer investment. Analysts, you know, funds will figure it out. So you won't get the big discount that you could get right now.
Right now, with a company that's losing money versus
exactly,
a company that's
so it's like a mixed bag. But yeah, I think definitely a couple more years at least. Martin Nielsen says, if Starlink is to be the cash cow for financing the execution of SpaceX's mission statement, wouldn't they want to sell as little stock in it as possible? Or how do you see it working out financially? So, yeah, I guess the question is, if it IPOs, I guess, will SpaceX keep most of Starlink shares and just, you know, sell some of that to over time, right, progressively? Or, like, I don't know, what's your take? Have you thought about kind of how that looks out?
Yeah. I think they'll get to a point where, you know, Elon will do a traditional IPO. I mean, he's voiced concern about the SPAC process, and I don't know why they do a direct listing. That's sort of the other thing. So I think they do it more of a traditional IPO. They wouldn't sell all of it. He'd keep a large portion. SpaceX would keep a large portion, or, you know, but they'd want to float it to the public and let investors get a piece of it. And hopefully it wouldn't be, you know, hopefully there'd still be a ton of growth left in Starlink, but it would sort of be at the point where like it's maybe close to break even. And that's my thought, that they would sell enough for the retail public to get a piece easily, or institutional firms trading, you know, public stocks to get a piece at probably a very lofty valuation by that point. You know, I can see it IPOing at 100 billion market cap, just at Starlink itself, you know, 3 years from now or something like that. That's, you know, entirely in the realm of possibility, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely going to be one of the most anticipated IPOs. I wish SpaceX would IPO too, but obviously they're not going to.
Yeah. If
I mean,
SpaceX
it's for
IPO
selfish
today,
reasons.
what do you think the valuation would be? I mean, I think the valuation of an IPO today would be closer to like 200 billion. What do you
Yeah,
think?
definitely. I think, especially because it has SpaceX and Starlink,
Starlink.
yeah.
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 I mean, it's trading on the private markets closer to 100 billion right now, right? Something like the last rate or last I've seen heard is closer to 100 billion on the private, but I think if it IPO'd, it'd be so much demand. It could easily IPO at 200 billion, but that's what people would buy it at, I think. Something like that. I mean, it's the premier space company, right? I mean,
I
if
know,
you want a
yeah.
piece of space and it was out there, it's the obvious answer. Like, if you believe in space, that's the best place. That's the best company to own a piece of,
Yeah.
and so
Yeah.
it would just demand. There'd be an incredible demand for the stock.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I probably have to disclose to, the audience here. I recently did make an investment in a SpaceX fund vehicle, meaning basically a fund that's invested into SpaceX. I've been looking at it for actually for quite a while. I had
Yeah.
opportunity over a year ago, but I felt like Tesla was like, I forget the stock price, but I felt it had some more room to appreciate. And so I
Yeah.
didn't pull the trigger on SpaceX. But this time around, I felt like I wanted to get in before just. It just feels like private market valuations are just all for all these
Over the
private
place.
companies, yeah, are getting bid up. So I wanted to get in before, SpaceX gets
Yeah.
over $100 billion market cap.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I think you
definitely.
did the right thing. You got in at the right time. I mean, when I got in a year and a half or a year ago, I think Tesla was, one fifth of the price it is now. I had to sell Tesla to buy Starlink. I mean, to buy SpaceX, and I got it like I think like a 38 billion valuation, but SpaceX is like 100 billion. So the SpaceX price went up, 1.5 times, 150%, but the Tesla stock went up 500%. So, I mean, I am happy I'm diversified, but you did a good job of holding out and waiting for your Tesla to go up, the 5x before you got into the Starlink at 1.5. So relatively speaking, you got a good deal.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, actually, I'm pretty happy that I waited, even though
Yeah.
SpaceX has been appreciating, but still
I
Tesla
mean, for us,
appreciated
it's
higher.
unique because we're mostly in Tesla, so we would have to sell Tesla to get into SpaceX. Other people, obviously, it would be a no-brainer no matter what, but for us, looking back, you got a good deal since you had to sell Tesla or you had to diversify out of Tesla potentially to do it.
Here's another Twitter user, Ed Rangdad says, "I'm worried about Cybertruck's design being too fancy. What do you think? The bed cover might not open in cold weather with ice. Number two, dirt stuck in the T-track in the bed. Number three, dirt stuck in the slope that gets pulled out from the gate." I think what I'm concerned about is that the lack of door handles. Did you read that by Elon saying something about the Cybertruck won't have door handles? It'll just automatically open when you
Yeah.
approach it or something. That reminds me
Yeah.
of the Model X like doors where
Yeah.
you've got some mixed results. I'm curious why they would kind of go back to that. Or I wonder if there's some type of feature where it's there's no door handle, but you touch that area like where there should be a door handle, and then the door opens automatically or something. There's an extra feature
Yeah.
or something. And it doesn't
I
make
think that'll
sense
be
that they would be like just approach it on like the Model X and automatically open. It seems like they would think through that and have some type of backup,
Yeah.
thing, but
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think the Cybertruck is very like dystopian. The Model X is utopian and the Cybertruck is a dystopian design, and I think going with that they're going to make it like rugged and like infallible. Like that's going to be key to how they engineer and produce it, is that it's not going to have those trivial issues like the Model X has or had early on, especially that the Cybertruck's just going to work. It's just one block of metal like stamped out, and just like these doors, just you touch them and they open automatically, or there's a fail safe, you pull it open or whatever, but it's just like there's very little. My feeling is they'll design in a way that's very light unlikely or very little that could go wrong. Like that's just the dystopian vision of like a vehicle. Like you got to have it just always be working, and I think that's where they're going to go with that. Yeah. That's my opinion. I don't know.
Yeah. Do you see some risk with Cybertruck not panning out exactly like as high a demand as some people think? Like, my concern is with Cybertruck that a lot of people that have reservations, they seem to be more like on the tech side, and maybe they live in metro areas, but they get the Cybertruck. My concern is like, this is a huge beast of a machine. This is like a big truck. It's not like a regular truck. It's a big monster of a truck.
Yeah.
And I don't even know if it's like going to be that great in a metro area, you know, like, and then the people who live outside of metro areas, or just let's say more suburbs, or even places where you use big trucks more so, it seems like they're not necessarily so tech heavy, you know, more traditional values and approaches. So I don't know if Cybertruck would completely appeal to them. So I don't know. It would seem like maybe a smaller truck would appeal to, you know, more of the metro, like urban population, tech loving population, than this big monster of a truck. I don't know. What are your thoughts?
Yeah. You know, you and I'm just thinking back to when you and I saw it in person, right? And we got that test drive and that thing rolled up on us. Yeah, we saw it roll up all those times and those big wheels, a laser light. It was like a monster. It looked like, wow. Mm-hmm. I just think there's too many people, you know, that want to have that and want to own that. You know, not, it might not be for everyone. You know, some people, it might be too much for, you know, that have reservations. They might have second thoughts, but like, I don't really want to be like showboating this monster truck type dystopian thing, you know. But I think a lot of people are just going to get a kick out of it. Me included. I'm going to get that, and I'm going to drive my kids around in that to school. Like, look at this thing, kid. You know, it's going to be, I'm going to feel like I'm like the most popular kid in sixth grade or something. It's, you know, I had the coolest toy, you know, like, I don't know. I'm looking forward to getting a kick out of driving this crazy, you know, mammoth around. And, you know, I think it'll be very functional, and I think that's going to drive, you know, a lot more people to buy it, you know, after early adopters like me. But I think there's probably hundreds of thousands of early adopters like me willing, like that are just Tesla fanatics and Elon fanatics that just want to just say, we want that, whatever you buy, you design Elon, I'm buying it. You know? Mm-hmm. One of the only things I didn't get, I think that he designed, was like the flamethrower, you know, I didn't get the flamethrower, but you know, I got almost everything else he's like put out there, you know, and it's been really cool, you know? So, I'm excited, and I think there's a lot of people excited. And even though there's like a million reservations, worst case is like, you know, 100,000 people end up buying it out of those first million instead of, you know, 500,000. You know, best case, 500,000, I think. You know, worst case, I think like only 100,000 of the million reservation holders buy it, you know, something like that. So that's just my gut feeling, but I think it'll be enough to like kick it off when people see them around towns and stuff. It'll catch on. General contractors will start getting it that are open-minded and look into it, and it'll just pick up from there.
I mean, I'm glad Tesla, Elon, they're doing the Cybertruck, because like, it's such a risky, bold move. It's like, to me, it's like, it's amazingly like designed well. It's just like it's just a masterpiece of design.
Changing the course of history of how trucks could be designed going forward, that, you know, only he can do. Like, no one else could.
Yeah, and it's the right product to do it, where you're not betting the whole company on it, right? It's not like the Model 3 or the Model Y. It's an extra kind of, you know, product. And I think, like, even if it doesn't do as well as some people expect, I think it can reincarnate itself, like the features, the expertise, the learnings in other types of vehicles, where you might have, you know, folded steel, like a more of a economy car or something that's just crazy, that sells millions later on. But there's something that I think Tesla's onto. I don't know if the Cybertruck is the ultimate, you know, realization of that, you know, but it does seem like this is the start of something, you know. Hopefully there'll be a whole line of cyber vehicles, you know, in the future.
I think so. I think there's gonna be some pretty crazy options with that thing too. Like, we saw the little the three wheel
ATV,
ATV there, and we talked to that guy who designed it briefly or whatever. So they'll have that. Mm-hmm. I think they'll have some other cool things, whether it's a drone or like a little, you know, dog humanoid robot. I don't know. There'll be some other weird little options. Like, you pull up somewhere, you let your freaking drone out to go check out the area, or you let your little humanoid robot go deliver whatever, go knock on, you know, do what it needs to do. You know, I think there'll be some really, you know, cool features that we haven't even thought of that'll be designed into it. I mean, Tesla's got like the most engineering talent out there of any company by far. They've been recruiting, like, you know, they have this AI day coming, which is going to be, you know, it's basically a recruitment day for the top machine learning, neural network, AI people, you know, coming out of school or out of school young enough to like put a lot of energy into, you know, the future, you know, so they're going to do some really cool stuff. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think, I mean, that's an interesting point. It's like, it's a combination where you've got this immense amount of talent, engineers, right, and mission and goal. But then Tesla's reached this point where they're profitable, they're free cash flow positive. So they've got billions of dollars now of extra money laying around that Elon can use to make big bets. Whereas before, he was like penny pinching, right, and trying to choose which projects. But now he could make kind of big bets. It's okay to fail on some of these bets. And it's kind of like, you know, with Apple and Google, they use so much of their cash just to like fund new things or to fund future growth. And I think Tesla's kind of getting into that place where, you can't bet against that because this is new products, new services, new business lines, you know, new features, just whole, you know, a maze of different things that are going to be developed, I think, in the coming years.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, imagine where Apple could be if Steve Jobs never passed away. You know, they would have all these cool new products. They probably would have, Tesla might not have been successful nearly as much, or they might have been bought out by Apple a long time ago if Steve Jobs was still around. So, you know, the difference is Elon Musk is still with Tesla and will be for the foreseeable future. And it's just incredible to think about what possibilities could come from this. And I think Elon Musk, you know, head to head with Steve Jobs, you know, they're both incredible people, visionaries, but I would put Elon Musk over Steve. If I had to pick one dream team CEO leader of my company that I was trying to invest in and starting from scratch, it would be Elon Musk over Steve Jobs.
Sure. Yep. Definitely. Me too. All right. Wanted to, let's wrap up this second section of our conversation and then we'll have one more section, a bunch of topics about the next Tesla catalyst, Tesla electric plane, the advantages and disadvantages of Tesla holding Bitcoin on their balance sheet, and a few other questions. But yeah, going to have a fun time. So anyways, cool. We'll see you guys in the next part. Thanks.